Good afternoon and welcome to Wanda's Picks. We are going to be hosting a series of conversations called The Mother Line. And our first guest in this series is Dr. Catherine Waddell Takara. She taught and developed the first Black Studies and Ethnic Studies department beginning in 1971 at the University of Hawaii. She transferred to interdisciplinary studies where she continued to develop new courses including Africana studies. Her primary research was African American history, politics, and culture. A winner of the BCF 2010 American Book Award, Catherine Waddell Takara, PhD poet, has published over 300 poems, 11 books of poetry, and numerous academic articles. She is currently a writer and traveling performance poet since retiring from the University of Hawaii in 2007 after 31 years of teaching. She is recognized as a widely traveled professor, public scholar of ethnic and Africana studies. She has traveled, taught, and performed her poetry within the United States of America, as well as Western Europe, West and South Africa, and Eastern China. She was born and raised in Tuskegee, Alabama, educated at Quaker George School and Tufts University on the East Coast, and studied in France twice. She earned a Fulbright scholarship, an MA in French from the University of California, Berkeley, and moved to Hawaii in 1968, where she earned a PhD in political science from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. She has been of service to the community as a coordinator and producer of many socio-political and cultural events. And so we are going to play a little music while we wait for Catherine to join us in the studio. And I am going to play Ain't I a Woman? I think. Let me see. Let me see. Oh, yeah, I like this one. Hey, Catherine. I was playing a little bit of Avery Sharp's Virtuous from his CD, Ain't I a Woman, about Sojourner Truth.
Yeah.
I thought it would be kind of fitting, since you're a Southern woman who has lots of stories. Yeah. So I read your bio while I was waiting for you to join me, the shorter one, so I don't need to read it again. And I want to thank you so much for helping me sort of test out this Motherline series of, you know, that I am kicking off this month, International Women's History Month, as I thought you'd be perfect. Yeah, given,
thank you.
I mean, you've actually, in your bloodline, you know, you all, you sort of like the history pulses, you know, of our people, you know, of captivity and freedom, and you just walk in it, literally. You're literally walking the freedom line, for sure. And
thank
I know your
you.
Ancestors
well,
are so
I'm
proud of you.
I'm still walking it. No,
I know,
you.
I know, I know. 80 years, my goodness, you've been around a minute, but you got hopefully going to be around a lot more, a lot longer.
Thank you. I hope so. So I look to the sky every morning and I shout gratitude and sing songs.
Nice. in your a bit of your personal history is so lyrical, but I'm going to let you, you know, I'm not going to read it. I'm going to let you talk. You know, you were born in Tuskegee, Alabama. It was like, you know, that's like a landmark.
Yes, it is. And my ancestors were on my mother's side were partially involved in its creation, because after slavery, my great-great-grandmother was she was a slave on the Chappelle plantation, which was French, and her husband was on the Young plantation, which was English, and they eventually got married formally right after freedom and came to our people in 1864 they got married. I'm not sure, but they moved to Lowndes County before they got married, Lowndes County, Alabama, from South Carolina, because the planter. But it's interesting that my mother became a French professor, and then I became a French professor. But of course, we didn't know any of this ancient ancestral history. Not ancestor, but you know what I mean, generational.
Yes.
And so we both became French majors. And then when they were in Lowndes County, when freedom actually really came in Lowndes County, then the family moved up to Tuskegee to help Booker T. Washington in some of the initial founding steps. Now, let's see. Hampton was involved in all of that, Booker T. And then I guess my great-great-grandfather also was somehow connected to Hampton, but didn't go there. But they went to Tuskegee, and that was the beginning of my mother line in terms of where my memory started.
Right. Yeah, that is so amazing, though, you know, that your mother taught French, and you, you know, I think, what, do you have a master's in French or something like that?
I do.
From UC Berkeley?
Yeah, I do.
And
I taught it for like 12 or 15 years before I switched totally over to Black Studies, Ethnic Studies.
Right. And then you think about, you know, the Francophone tradition, and there's so much, oh my goodness, history, and you know that because you visited, you know, Africa and on a number of occasions, and to be able to speak French, you know, it's a colonizer language, but it gives us access to each other.
Yes, and before that, I had gotten a Fulbright Fellowship to do translations of West African and Caribbean writers, and it led back to their being influenced by people like American writers, even like Langston Hughes. So it's this circular diasporic connection that you know, has kept it moving forward and exposed us to more and more of our traditional similarities. And let me say that my mother sent me off to France and when I was a sophomore in college, and it was the first time that I ever felt free. I mean, and it was a measure of freedom, but it was free. And it was that made me decide to become a French major, and I wanted to be an expat because I did not want to live in the likes of Alabama and the racism that existed in the United States. So, yeah, it was a journey.
Wow. Was that the first time you ever were away from home when you studied in France?
No, I went to that Quaker boarding school in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which influenced my whole spiritual side. But I went there because the conditions in Alabama were rugged and integration, so to speak, had just opened up. And so there were quite a few Tuskegee kids of my age that went north and east to get a better education at the time. We used in our high school and anything that wasn't affiliated with the HBCU Tuskegee, we used, I mean, secondhand books was the way it went.
So parents
wanted that good education as a means to escape, and you know, to escape not from our blackness, but to have more freedom.
Oh, wow. So tell us some stories about being a little black girl in Alabama, because, you know, your parents probably tried to shield you and protect you, but if, you know, you had to go to a boarding school, obviously, and you grew up under segregation in the Jim Crow era of this particular nation, which kind of never really ended to date. But, yeah, talk to us about some of these stories, you know, that are really indelible, because I know some of it, like your cousin, you know, died really tragically.
Well, there are the pluses and the minuses. Tuskegee was a very sheltered, educated community. We also have the biggest black VA hospital, maybe the only one, in the country. And so Tuskegee is full of doctors and nurses and educated folk, and then the university and the professors and the librarians. And so there was a lot of black history that wasn't necessarily taught in school, but we were living it, and our parents and everyone around us was always referring to it. So that was very empowering. On the other hand, there were the daily humiliations if one had to go downtown, which was white, and stand at the back of the line of all the white people that were ahead of you, or be submitted to improper naming. Every black woman might have been a Sally or a Mary or whatever the white person chose to call them, regardless of whether they had a PhD or a master's or whatever. Couldn't try on shoes, could see the movies once a week in the what do they call it, the peanut gallery, you know, upstairs in the movie house. We went to Montgomery to be able to try on shoes and hats and clothes, and even that was not necessarily the best experience. There were not places to eat except kind of run-down places to have lunch. My teeth were crooked. My mother took me all the way to Birmingham, Alabama, with a girlfriend. We were kids, little, ten. And then we had to wait forever just to, this was at the University of Alabama Dental School, and we had to wait forever to get seen by not an intern, but whatever they are. So we quit that practice after a while. I mean, that routine of going to straighten my teeth in Birmingham, it was a long trip, and it was kind of a humiliating trip. So in essence, I didn't travel. My mother did not take me traveling, nor my father, in the Deep South, ever. If she wanted to stay in a nice hotel, once a year we would go north to Philadelphia or to New York, and there she would do her shopping. She liked style, so she would do her clothes shopping, and she had a narrow foot. She would do her shoe shopping. And so it was very privileged and at the same time segregated, demeaning, name being victim of name calling, not just nigger, but as I said, just misnaming. So it was a mixed bag. And then when I went to the all-white Quaker school, I was still coming up. I was, when did I go there? Maybe I was 14. I was very popular, being the only one, except for one other black student who, her father was president of South Carolina, I forget which HBCU, but she looked white, so no one knew she was black. Mm-hmm. And so I went there, I guess you could say, burdened with stereotypes of black people and what people expected. But I was embraced. I was welcomed. But when it came to anything social, I was hurt because boys wouldn't dance with me. And I grew up dancing, house parties and all that stuff in the South, because we didn't have anything else to do but have house parties. We didn't have movies except the one I told you about. And, you know, there weren't bowling alleys or just things that young people do. So we had our house party. So I loved to dance. Then when I got to the Quaker school, anyone that asked me to dance, they'd hear about it the next day or so. And that carried over to Tufts, where I went to college, university. There was a big social stigma. I couldn't join any sororities. There were no black sororities at that school. There were maybe a couple of guys I could have dated. So I had to go away from the college to date, in a sense. It was just interesting. I mean, it was painful, but I had this strong black tradition, this foundation. I can remember, again, being very young, and my mother and the mothers would go out to Moton Field, where the Tuskegee Airmen practiced. And, of course, Benjamin Davis II was my godfather. He was the second black general. His father was the first black general. And so we would go out there and play at the creek, be mindful of the water moccasins or whatever. But there were these illustrious people, although only recognized by our communities, and I say that plural, black communities. But nationally, it was, 40 years later when we really started to get our due.
Wow. So you say in France was where you finally felt free?
Yes.
Huh. How old were you?
Oh, that was my first year in college. So I was 18.
You were 18? Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, wow. Yeah. Did your mother and father, did they ever travel abroad with you?
My mom, being the French major, she went with me. Yeah. Do you want me to read you a poem about this time, about my mother?
Oh, certainly.
Or not quite yet.
No, this is perfect. No, there's
okay.
Yeah, I don't have a program, so no.
Okay. So, there was one that came out in a recent book, my book called Footprints, Wings, and Phantasms, and it was called Mama's Lap. Protected on Mama's lap, I crossed the highway at Greens Fork, Tuskegee, Alabama. I witnessed fiery clannish rites, mob mentality, rituals of terror. I listened to Mama's voice, heard her inspired intention, reading me stories, fairy tales, verses, comfortable on her favorite periwinkle blue upholstered chair, observing clear echoes of long-ago cultures. Mama educated her child, explained fables, legends, myths, Ali Baba, Aladdin, Scheherazade, along with flawed leaders, Cleopatra, Hatshepsut, Solomon, as well as goddesses and gods, Isis, Shiva, Shango, and lessons of great teachers, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, and more. Mama taught protocols. Enter in the eastern door. Exit in the west. Honor the guest. Respect others. Absorb wisdom. Promote agency. Sitting on Mama's lap, I learned to stay strong. Seek vibrancy and healing change. Engage in learning. Fly toward puzzling stars. So much to remember and value. Her instruction in my early youth, mostly unrecognized, now cherished. Sitting on Mama's lap.
Yeah, that's perfect. Let me go into a little more detail about your spirituality, and I love the line about the protocol and the line, sitting on Mother's lap, I learned to stay strong. Yeah, that's really, really lovely. Yeah. Talk a little bit about your spirituality, because, you know, the going to these spaces where you were the only one that looked like a black woman, you know, and then other places where you were the only one. I don't know what that feels like. Well, I do a little bit. When I went to USF, I was the only American African American. And there were like three of us. One sister was from Liberia, and she didn't identify with me. And then one of my other classmates was Jamaican, and he didn't identify with me. And then there was me. Sort of like isolated. They had to actually bring in someone from another department to read my work. This was when I was working on my master's in writing, because they wanted to you know, give me the best reading, and they felt that they, administrators didn't feel that they were competent to read my work, for whatever that means. So anyway, so in that way, I kind of know what it means to be the lonely one, but in your situation, you were the only one. There weren't Africans from the diaspora with you. You were it.
Yes, at that time. That would be in 59 to 61, I guess. 58 to 61. Okay, well, spirituality. Well, it's interesting because religion was very, very strong, you know, in our communities. But my mother was orphaned when she was seven and eight. And I think she kind of lost faith in God at that point, even though, you know, she went to church and this and that. But, and then Tuskegee being as it was, a lot of the black professionals, it went to the Episcopal Church, which is more subdued than our Baptist Church, which was always very fun and very exciting with the music and the spirit and all of that and the preaching and everything. But so she would classify herself, I think, as an agnostic, which was kind of unheard of. But it wasn't like she broadcasted it, but that was what she felt. My father, neither of my parents were really church going, but they always made sure that I went. And for religious holidays, and I was confirmed, and I was baptized, and I was confirmed, and all of that. So by the time I got to George School, the Quaker school, they had meditation or quiet time every morning before going to classes, where you would just sit, and occasionally someone would have something to share about our humanness or about anti-war, but they didn't say it in that way, but peace, I guess, would be the message. But it was the quiet time, I don't know whether it was 20 minutes or 30 minutes, but it was a time to settle down. It was a time to reflect. And for me, it was a new learning. of how to settle into myself. And that was super important in terms of the direction that my spirituality allowed doors to open and new ways of a kind of gratitude to settle in, or this peace thing, this inner peace as I grew and knowing of myself. And so that was something that meditative practice, something that I took with me from the Quaker school, and it kind of was a foundation for anything else that I did in the area of religion. By the time I got to finished graduate school and moved to Hawaii, it led me, that reflection and that seeking of what is my true essence and what is God, or those kinds of questions. I started to study the works of one is a psychologist, the psychology of man's possible evolution. We have to put woman in there too. And that is a practice of self-observation, non-judgment, liberation, that I have followed from 1972 until now.
Mm-hmm.
So every morning I do prayers, I do meditation. Sometimes I do exercise, not as much as I used to, but all of it, if it's Tai Chi, then that's a meditation. If mm-hmm. it's walking, that's a meditation. If it's just in the garden, which is my temple or my church, that is my meditation. So I try during the day at all times, really, to stay in touch with this higher part of myself. And that goes into my writing. It goes into my relationships. It goes into my travels. It goes into my witnessing. And there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was almost like, you know, you were being prepared because you kind of took your,
the road less traveled.
yeah, but you took, going back to this poem, let's see, what you learned, you know, on your mother's lap, you took it on the road, so to speak, in your career. I mean, you
yes,
were the
even
only
in my
one
lectures in
time.
China, the eight mm-hmm. summers that I spent in China, and not all eight summers, but mm-hmm. I would teach Black studies and Black literature and minority women and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I took it. I have another poem to share with you. It's on a different tone.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And actually, I wrote this from a mother mm-hmm. to a child, a daughter, and it's called Bittersweet. Bittersweet, memory of childhood palaces, given up like dead to the sea of tomorrow's tides. Bittersweet, temptation glowing like neon, youth's reckless desire for freedom, assuming immortality. Bittersweet, jazz punctuating the smoking crowd, nightclub stars passing mechanically under synthetic moonlight and strobe lights. Bittersweet, child becoming woman and suffering fires and dirges. Echoes of Chopin creating nostalgic sonatas in lonely solitude. Bittersweet, Adonis leaving Venus for the chase, the goddess of love being temporarily absent. Bittersweet, bittersweet, the fallen plumeria blossoms trodden on the path of becoming, withered from the source. Bittersweet, Ishmael's banishment with Hagar, melancholy reality of leaving the hearth for unforeseeable shores. Bittersweet, changing moods of nature from clouds to winds, from sun to snow. Bittersweet, nationalist, struggling for independence, nurturing rebellions with waves of resistance, dying still young. Bittersweet, indecision wavers at volcano's edge. Lava burns the summer harvest, nearby homes, parching imagination and action. Bittersweet, shattered dream of immaculate conception, missing the mark, only to be alone in love and in life. Bittersweet, bittersweet specter of success, garland of thorny crown, transient dance of the shifty eyes. Bittersweet, intimate songs of the changing tides, corresponding to the ethereal lyre of the heart, rarely heard by mortal ears. Bittersweet, visions which are but fragments of shadows and shapes, in fractions of time incomplete. Bittersweet, scenes flickering like lanterns, drifting on a passing water, on a passing river. Bittersweet.
Oh, that is really beautiful. I don't know, it was so melodious, like a song. Yeah, wow, it's so beautiful, bittersweet. It's like a autobiography, you know?
Mm-hmm.
heard some names in there. It's like, oh, Ishmael.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, and then you even have music, you know, you have the jazz, you have Chopin, you have, you know, Adonis, and you've got flowers falling and growing and things changing, and, yeah, I love volcanoes. And you live, you live
you
on
gotta
an
come,
island that
you
was
gotta
formed
come back
by,
over here.
yeah. And then, you know, garland of thorny crown. Wow. And when I see pictures of you, you have on lays all the time, you know, the flowers.
Yeah, nature is a huge influence in my life, in my solace, in my writing. I remember when I was at the Quaker school, I would walk down to the lake or walk down in the trees. It was a large, lots of acres. And that was always my comfort, my peace, my inspiration.
Yeah. So were you there, see, 4 years?
No, three.
Three, okay.
I went my sophomore year in high school.
And did you go home for the holidays or something?
Yes, I would go home.
Yeah.
I would be invited home to classmates and friends. I would be invited for the short vacations like Thanksgiving or, you know, shorter ones. And then I would they would invite me, and then their parents would say, oh, no, the neighbors, or oh, no, whatever reasons. Until my senior year, I actually got to go to Greenwich Village with my roommate. And that was eye-opening, to say the least. She lived
How's
upstairs
that?
From Bob Dylan. Imagine that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
I know.
And you...
On McDougal Street.
Did you meet him?
Yeah, we went down and I had my first smoke. Oh, anyway.
Oh. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, my life has been just magical. Full. I mean, there's been the pain, you know. I mean, there's been the pain. There's been the rage. But there's also been the... the doors and the windows that opened me up to more.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
go ahead.
You have a poem?
Mm-hmm.
Go
called Women's Woman's Work.
Oh, I like the title.
Woman's Work, bearer of tradition in a field of foreign. She remembers the ancients, nurturing moments in performance, exercising her wings of new age, Aquarian gatherer. She who remembers the dance to the center, the harmony of humming. She drums the red rhythms of moon rituals on her thighs, chants invocations to the angel of joy. She is the dream carrier, but not the dream, mother and earth incomplete. Illness of overwork swoops down in a lunge, sudden, like stumbling energy, dislocation, light shatters in shards of sick. She falls in a ball, rests like a gourd, rolls on the winter ground, gathering her smoldering powers. She returns secretly to the sacred green place within, lights a fire at her hidden altar, awaiting the beloved to balance her truth, to plant a vision, to share new seeds. She awaits the appearance, the cleansing touch, a healing breath of moments love, transforming the fire to rain.
Wow. That's really lovely. Thinking about nurturing moments in performance, moon rituals, dream carrier, not dream, and the sacred green space within. Oh, my goodness, the sacred green space within. Talk a little bit more. You've been talking about your gardens. I was wondering what seeds have been planted that you maybe didn't plant that are sprouting now that you are just noticing in this green space within?
Well, I have a new project. I have endless projects, but this is called the Sammy Young Project. And that was my cousin, my first cousin, as you mentioned, who was killed in Tuskegee, which totally tore up the community. It was so complacent and privileged, I guess you could say. And he was always a bundle of fire and resistance, looking half white or more, always trying to prove how black he was, how much a part of the tradition he was, which he was. And then worked with Kwame Ture, and in Lowndes County voter registration, Mississippi registration, and was home in Tuskegee, was meeting his girlfriend at the bus stop after the Christmas holidays, and decided he was going to the white bathroom at the tiny bus stop, which was no bigger than a big room, not even a big room, a 12 by 12 room or whatever, maybe 15 by 15, small. And so he went and said, asked to use the bathroom with the key, and the man said, "Nigger, whatever, you can't use this here." And he said, "I have my rights," and he could rattle off everything. And the man pulled out a gun and said, "You're not going to do this." So he said, "I'm going to get the police," and he went two blocks away to get the police, and what happened? They said, "I'll go on back down there. We'll come down after a while." And he went back and got into a further argument, and with the gun, got chased onto the arriving bus, not his girlfriend's bus, but the bus. And the bus driver said, "Hey, TVs are on." The man followed him onto the bus, to the steps.
With
and
the gun?
"You can't be acting like this," because it was, it was 1966.
Oh, wow.
And put my cousin, you know, time to go. All the people witnessed all of that. Time to go. The bus pulls out after my cousin and the other man, Mr. Segrist, get off. And then he starts to run, and he had grabbed the golf club.
Mm-hmm.
He was running away with his golf club, and he was shot in the back of the head. And he lay there for a few hours before the police deigned to come down, meaning around two blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
So that radicalized everybody, totally radicalized everybody. But he was like my brother. And we, you know, we would go to the creek together at Moton Field. And, you know, I mean, we were just, oh, and his dad would take us riding in the car every Sunday on the dirt roads in Alabama. And there would inevitably be a snake line on the road. And he would just stop the car. And I would scream. And Sammy would laugh. And his brother Steve, who recently passed, they would both laugh at me, because I was so frightened. But anyway, what am I trying to say about all of that? Nature?
Oh.
Was I talking about my spiritual side? Was I talking about inspiration? What
you
was
were talking
the question,
about what's
and
growing
did I answer
now.
It?
You were talking about what's growing now, what seeds
oh, what's growing
are sprouting
now. Oh,
in
yes,
the
yes, yes, yes. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So Sammy, this cousin, there's a play, there's a book. There was a community center, which eventually closed. But when I was on my recent trip to Tuskegee in September of this year, I mean of 2023, a few months ago, I met a woman. Oh, well, my girlfriend, my classmate who had been mayor, organized a meeting for a contingent of us from Hawaii. There were like eight of us that went down and to discuss our community issues with Tuskegee community issues. That was not the whole purpose. The purpose was a civil rights journey. But anyway, the result of it was I met the councilwoman who was at the dinner thing and group meeting that night, and she has started this Tuskegee project to create from the family house, the young family house, a museum, a research center, and a place where graduate students and community folk can go and research civil rights, but at Sammy's house, parents' house. And then we have a piece, they've gotten a piece of land that they're going to make a peace and meditation garden, which is in the same, they're trying to create a two-block parcel, everything devoted to civil rights and Sammy, named in his name. And the university, Tuskegee University, the president, the history department, the library, all of these people, as well as civil rights workers like Cleve Sellers or Wendy Paris, or people that worked with Sammy and Stokely and all of that. And so it's rich. Once a month we meet and we discuss our progress on buying the home and oral histories. And it's just rich. It's just so rich. I'm excited about the people that are showing up, people that knew Sammy, people full of stories, people of the period, and now younger people who want to, you know, see this thing through. So that is one of my many projects for right now, talking about. And I'm bringing Carla into it so that the legacy can continue, and Natasha.
Nice, nice. Well, talk about yourself as mother and grandmother.
Well, a mother, love endureth. Okay, so mothering, we went through health challenges, major, with both daughters, one with her back and the other one with her seizure disorder. And so having to be present for that with those those many events while teaching, while mothering, while being a wife, while developing this rather large property that we have as the manager. I think I gave maybe too much freedom or opportunity to choose, but I was in this work, this psychological self-development, inner work, and so I think that rubbed off, as well as I was being a poet, of course, and a professor. So I think that rubbed off in some kind of ways without my pushing any kind of agenda. Carla went with me to endless things, you know, Angela Davis and protests and occupying buildings and all that kind of stuff. So she's very socially conscious and aware. And then Natasha, I call her my Japanese daughter, but she has absorbed so much that I did not know, that she is such a loving, giving, deep, reflective, but exciting mother who does as I did in terms of making sure that the kids get to all the track meets or the sports activities or the, but both my, neither of my daughters, I think, took their daughters to church in the way that, that I did. So their spiritual side is more, I guess, reflective of the times that we live in. They are deeply spiritual, but they don't necessarily attend church. I tried to, well, Carla, we would go to that, what's that church in Oakland?
East Bay?
Yeah, we would go to the East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
But when
Reverend,
I took Natasha.
Reverend, mm-hmm. Reverend Oliver?
This was the lady.
Yeah, Eloise Oliver. Mm-hmm.
Eloise, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took Natasha to a Haitian
mm-hmm.
ceremony because I had been healed and given the gift of healing hands when I had almost died from an illness. And so I wanted to go to his church, but it was so intense. It was so intense. People were, you know, just getting the spirit and falling out, and it was just very noisy and very intense. And I think with Natasha, that kind of made her say, "Oh, I don't know whether I want to, I don't know whether I want to go to church or what." But they both are, I think, have a very deep spiritual, and I think that that is the best and the best thing that I can give them is that strength of inner knowing and inner and a humility in their ways. Both of them were quite beautiful, but I always steered them away from the placing value on physical beauty, not to be models or not to be, you know, not putting them in that childhood world of modeling and all of that, which I have friends that did that. But no, I wanted my daughters to be humanists and loving and intellectual. That was what my wish was, and that was what happened as one went to Vassar and one went to Stanford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely an achievement.
So mothering was a full-time thing for me in addition to all the other stuff. I mean, even though I was teaching or this or that, I was always mothering. I was always mothering, and I'm still mothering. I'm still very in touch with the daughters. I have a new poem that I've been working on. I won't read it because it's time to go. But
oh,
it's called...
You can share it if you like.
It's called Passwords and Promises. I can't read it to you yet, but it says, we need new names, and that's in the
mm-hmm.
title of a book, and we need passwords, and we need new passwords, and we need new promises, because pay attention, what's happening.
Oh, wow. How lovely. What a great place to conclude. Ah, so when's your poem going to be finished? And what's it, is it going to be in your new
book?
One? Yeah, the
oh,
one
my
that
new
you're
book
not
sharing. Is my new book that I'm working on, which I have an editor that's willing to cut it in half. It's called Rambling
mm-hmm.
Time. And
wow.
It has various, it's kind of autobiographical, I guess you could say. So that's what I'm working on. It will have include travels and civil rights and early, you know, it's poems. It's a poetry thing. It's not my memoir, which I'm still not working on, which I should be. I have my same 200 pages that I've had for a couple of 3 years. But I think if I can, I would like to end with a poem called Walk Strong.
Okay. Can I ask you a question before you? Okay.
Yes.
Before you read the poem, I wanted to ask you, trying to look at these questions I have, like, I was wondering, what would you have liked to know that you can share with other women now?
That love comes in many forms. What we dream of as love shifts. And as an 80-year-old woman, I still feel excited and I can still have a good lovemaking session.
Wow, really? Okay. Okay.
And
nice.
it can be various. And it doesn't have to be with the husband or the partner. So the opening. I think it's about opening and deepening. Opening and deepening. As long as we are alive.
Yes. Okay, thank you. So if you'd like to share your poem, that'd be super.
I'll end with this one. It's called Walk Strong. We women, genetic shape shifters in the cosmic wind, sidestep toward horn of the moon. Cloudy communication comes through an open window in a lower room. Crazy connections, confused by irregular character of being. We women, buffeted by unpredictable excursions emotional, walk tall, remain hopeful and strong, open to intuitive messages and new doors. Revelations arrive on a bright clearing field along the path to clarity. We women excavate, explicate, extricate feeling, discover healing touch and pleasurable sensations along the petal-strewn path toward transition. We women are compassion, hard seeds, fragile blossoms, miracles of spring, open to challenging views. We women, shapeshifters, share alchemy of nurturing visions and voices. Ride the invisible forces beyond the clouds of limitation to experiences and places diverse. We women walk strong.
We women walk strong. Oh, wow, that's so lovely. Oh, thank you so much, Catherine, for this wonderful conversation and all the lovely poetry. My goodness.
It is my pleasure, and thank you for remembering and inviting me, yes.
Oh, I just love the way you're so, you like saying yes to me. I appreciate it. You don't always know where you're going.
Oh, laughter is on my things to do today, even when I face my taxes.
Yeah, good luck on that.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
I was going to play Artie Shep's revolution, just because I like it, and you are certainly a revolutionary. You keep on turning and turning and turning. But for future broadcasts, I was wondering, do you have a favorite song? You mentioned a few in, or hinted at a few in the poetry, but they didn't have titles. They just had, you know, a songwriter.
I like Nina Simone.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Okay. Any particular one or all of hers?
Oh, not a title that I can think of, but I really like her, you know, Loving Being Black or What Black Is.
Oh, To Be Young, Gifted in Black, that one?
Yeah,
that she wrote
I love
for
that.
Lorraine Hansberry? Yeah.
I love that.
Me too. Oh, that's nice. Okay, well, I will.
And there is a jazz song called Up Jump Spring, so I'll just leave
oh,
you
yeah.
with that thought.
Okay. Yeah, happy spring.
Thank you. We'll be in touch.
Cool.
And I'll be there.
I'll
be there in August. I mean, excuse me, in June.
June, right? Right.
And
right,
I'll also be there
you.
For that Black Fire mm-hmm. This Time reading. In,
oh, you will.
April 24th, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I look forward
and
to it.
And that's
going to
be like a 3-day quick visit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. 3-day quick visit. All righty. Look forward to seeing you then.
Good.
Good luck
Alrighty.
With all the projects. All right. You take good care.
Bye. Thank you. You too, Wanda.
Sure. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So here is Nina Simone. To Be Young, Gifted in Black, 1970.
Lisa, and I also want to talk about a friend who I miss more and more every day, every day. It seems that she comes alive more and more every day, for there are all kinds of things written about her each day more and more. And I'm talking about Lorraine Hansberry.
Oh, I have another one that says clearer, so let me play that one. This one here is not as clear. Maybe I did something to it.
Morning. Quite recently, there was an article in the New York Times on Lorraine Hansberry and a play downtown off Broadway called To Be Young, Gifted in Black, produced by her. And there was a picture of her there. And it was a picture that I have seen many times before. But photography, as you know, has its own way of communicating, just as all mediums do. And all I can tell you is that this picture caught hold of me. And in her eyes, this will sound very strange, but not to people who are really hip, she kept trying to tell me something. I was sitting on the bed. And I remember distinctly saying, I would keep looking at the picture and keep looking at the picture. And of course, the memory of being with her many times kept coming, flooding back in my memory. But I said, and I remember, inspiration is a very strange thing. Sometimes it just happens like a light. And I remember getting a feeling in my body. And I said, that's it. To be young, gifted in black, that's all. And sat down at the piano at that moment and made up a tune. And it just flowed out of me. I knew what I wanted it to say in essence, but I couldn't get the words together. So I called up my musical director and told him what was on my mind, explained to him a little bit about Lorraine Hansberry because he didn't know her. And he captured the mood, and the song was born less than 2 days later. And that's been less than a month ago. So I really think that she gave it to me. That's what I mean when I say that.
To be young, gifted and black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream. To be young, gifted and black.
now in the whole world, you know. There's a million boys and girls who are young, gifted and black, and that's a fact. You are young, gifted and black. We must begin to tell our young. There's a world of girls waiting for you. Yours is a quest that's just begun. So when you're feeling alienated and real low, there's a great truth that you should know. To be young, gifted and black, your soul's intact. Don't you forget it. Your soul's intact. Oh, good now. Yes, 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 yes. Langston Hughes is gone, but he meant the same thing. You know about Billy, poor Billy. They killed her for the very same thing that you gave a party on. You know, they killed her because she smoked pot. Really, they killed her. Now, of course, Lorraine is gone. Enough, 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 Selena. Feels so good. By the way, this is a black orchid given to me last night. Where were we? Which Jersey City? By the Black Students Council, and I preserved it until tonight so you could see it. Aye. Okay, this is the last one.
To be young, gifted and black. Oh, how I long to know the truth. There are times when I look back and I am haunted by my youth. But my joy